This is Lecture 9 of the series Inflation and Price Controls.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. In Lecture 8, elaborating on the essential ideas supplied by von Mises, I explained why socialism must fail economically. Specifically, I showed why socialism must constitute an anarchy of production and a system of the exploitation of labor, in which living standards fall below the minimum subsistence level and people simply starve to death. Tonight, as promised, I will show why socialism destroys individual freedom and creates a totalitarian dictatorship. My discussion will confirm the principle that freedom is indivisible, that there can be no political freedom without economic freedom, and no so-called civil or human rights without property rights. I want to stress again that when I speak of socialism, I am speaking of all variants of socialism. The socialism of the allegedly respectable socialists, such as the Social Democrats, as well as the socialism of the Nazis and communists. I stress this fact because a widespread misconception prevails that somehow the, quote, good socialists could achieve socialism by peaceful means and thereafter preserve political freedoms and civil liberties. That is not so, and it has never been so. And please do not think that countries like Britain, Israel, and Sweden are exceptions. As we saw in Lecture 8, those countries are not, in fact, socialist countries, but mixed economies. The violent, bloody means that have everywhere been employed to achieve socialism and the perpetual reign of terror that follows thereafter are no accident, but are caused by the very nature of socialism. Socialism is a thoroughly evil end, necessitating evil means for its achievement, and necessarily producing the most evil consequences. Let us begin by considering the means employed to achieve socialism. We observe two phenomena that are not unrelated. Namely, first, wherever socialism has actually been openly enacted, as in the communist countries, violent and bloody means have been used to achieve it. And second, where socialist parties have come to power, but have abstained from wholesale violence and bloodshed, as in Great Britain, Israel, and Sweden, they have not enacted socialism, but retained a mixed economy, which they did not radically or fundamentally alter. Let us consider the reasons for these facts. Observe, even if a socialist government were democratically elected, its first act in office in implementing socialism would have to be an enormous act of violence, namely the forcible expropriation of the means of production. The democratic election of a socialist government would not change the fact that the seizure of property against the will of its owners is an act of force. A forcible expropriation of property based on a democratic vote is about as peaceful as a lynching based on a democratic vote. It is a cardinal violation of individual rights. The only way that socialism could truly come into existence by peaceful means would be if property owners voluntarily donated their property to the socialist state. But consider, if socialism had to wait for property owners to voluntarily donate their property to the state, it would almost certainly have to wait forever. If socialism is ever to exist, therefore, it can only come about by means of force. Force applied on a massive scale against all private property. Observe further. In the case of the socialization of the entire economic system, as opposed to that of an isolated industry, no form of compensation to the property owners is possible. In the case of an isolated nationalization, the government can largely compensate the loss of the former owners by taxing the rest of the property owners to some extent. If the government seizes all property, however, and simply abolishes private ownership, then there is just no possibility of compensation. the government simply steals everyone's property, lock, stock, and barrel. In these circumstances, property owners will almost certainly resist and try to defend their rights by force if necessary, as they properly should. This explains why it takes the communists to achieve socialism, and why the social democrats always fail to achieve socialism. The communists, in effect, know that they are out to steal all of men's property from them, and that if they expect to succeed, they had better come armed and prepared to kill the property owners, who will attempt to defend their rights. The social democrats, on the other hand, are held back by fear from taking the steps that would be necessary to achieve socialism. In sum, the essential facts are these. Socialism must commence with an enormous act of theft. Those who seriously want to steal must be prepared to kill those whom they plan to rob. In effect, the social democrats are mere con men and pickpockets who engage in empty talk about pulling the, quote, big job, socialism, someday, and who flee before the first sign of resistance by their intended victims. The communists, on the other hand, are serious about pulling the big job. They are armed robbers prepared to commit murder. That is why the communists are able to implement socialism, while the social democrats are unable to implement socialism. Of the two, only the communists are willing to employ the bloody means that are necessary to implement socialism. Now, if socialism is not to be achieved by open force, the only other way it can be achieved is behind people's backs, which is the method of price and wage controls. But however socialism may be achieved, whether by open force or by stealth, its maintenance requires a reign of terror. It requires an environment in which people cannot trust even their friends, an environment in which they are afraid to express any ideas of their own or even to ask questions. It requires precisely the kind of environment that existed in Nazi Germany and that exists in every socialist country today. In order to begin to understand this point, let us consider merely the requirements of enforcing price and wage controls in an economy that is falling under the rule of de facto socialism. Let us imagine our own economy suffering from universal price controls and universal shortages, and observe what would be required just to enforce the price control regulations and prevent the development of a black market so large as to make the price controls largely meaningless. Imagine, therefore, that we have a fully price-controlled economy and that enough time has gone by to create shortages of practically everything. Imagine that we have gasoline shortages, meat shortages, power shortages, shoe shortages, shortages of all goods. Now, in these conditions, every seller would have a powerful self-interest in charging higher prices than the law allowed. And every buyer would have a powerful self-interest in offering to pay such higher prices as a means of outbidding others in order to obtain a larger supply for himself. How could the government stop the buyers and sellers from pursuing their mutual self-interests and transacting business above its ceiling prices? Obviously, there would have to be penalties imposed for selling above the ceiling prices. But what kind of penalties? If a seller stood to make an extra $10,000 or $20,000 a year, say, by defying the price control regulations, an occasional small fine would certainly not be a sufficient deterrent. And probably even the smallest neighborhood shops would stand to take in far more than that amount of extra income by defying the regulations. If the government were serious about its price controls, therefore, it would be necessary for it to impose severe penalties. Penalties comparable to those for a major felony. But the mere existence of such penalties would not be enough. The government would also have to be able actually to catch the violators and obtain convictions. It would have to make it actually dangerous to conduct black market transactions. It would have to make people fear that in conducting such a transaction, they might somehow be discovered by the police and actually end up in jail. In order to create such fear, the government would have to develop an army of secret informers and spies. For example, the government would have to make a storekeeper and his customer fearful that if they engaged in a black market transaction, some other customer in the store would report them. Because of the privacy and secrecy in which many black market transactions might be conducted, the government would have to make anyone contemplating a black market transaction fearful that the other party might turn out to be a police agent trying to trap him. The government would have to make people fearful of their longtime associates, even of their friends and relatives, lest even they turn out to be informers. And finally, in order to obtain convictions, the government would have to place the decision about innocence or guilt in the case of black market transactions in the hands of an administrative tribunal. It could not rely on jury trials because it would be unlikely that many juries could be found willing to bring in guilty verdicts in cases in which a man might have to go to jail for several years for the crime of selling a few pounds of meat or a pair of shoes above the ceiling price. In sum, therefore, the requirements merely of enforcing price control regulations would be the adoption of essential features of a totalitarian state, namely, the establishment of the category of economic crimes in which the peaceful pursuit of material self-interest is treated as a criminal offense, and the establishment of a totalitarian police apparatus replete with spies and informers and the power of arbitrary arrest and imprisonment. Clearly, the enforcement of price controls requires a government similar to that of Hitler's Germany or Stalin's Russia. If the government is unwilling to go to such lengths, then to that extent, its price controls prove unenforceable and simply break down. The black market then assumes major proportions. Now observe that in a socialized economy, a black market also exists. Only in this case, its existence entails the commission of further crimes. Under de facto socialism, the production and sale of goods in the black market entails the defiance of the government's regulations concerning production and distribution, as well as the defiance of its price controls. For example, the goods themselves that are sold in the black market are intended by the government to be distributed in accordance with its plan and not in the black market. The factors of production used to produce those goods are likewise intended by the government to be used in accordance with its plan and not for the purpose of supplying the black market. Under a system of de jure socialism, such as exists in Soviet Russia, all black market activity necessarily entails the misappropriation of state property. From the point of view of the legal code of a socialist state, most black market activity must be regarded simply as the theft of state property. For example, the factory workers or managers in Soviet Russia who turn out products that they sell in the black market are considered as stealing the raw materials supplied by the state. Observe further. In a socialist state, the government's economic plan is part of the supreme law of the land. We have already seen in Lecture 8 how chaotic the so-called planning process of socialism is. Its further disruption by workers and managers siphoning off materials and supplies to produce for the black market is something which a socialist state is logically entitled to regard as an act of sabotage. And that is how the legal code of a socialist state does regard it. Consistent with this fact, black market activity in a socialist state often carries the death penalty. In Nazi Germany, people were beheaded for it. In Soviet Russia, they are shot. Even apart from possible indulgence in black market activity, every socialist official who has responsibility for production necessarily leads a dangerous life. On the one hand, any use of factors of production in a way different than that specified by the state's economic plan lays such an official open to a charge of sabotage. On the other hand, it is generally impossible for the state's plan to be very precise, as we have seen. And so some discretion must be used. Since a socialist economic system functions in a state of continuous chaos and chronic crisis, it is very easy for any given official to be singled out and blamed for some disaster caused by socialism's anarchy of production. It becomes an essential talent under socialism for an official to be able to know how to cover himself and always to have scapegoats of his own at hand. From the top to the bottom, an incredible game of buck passing, favor trading, and mutual blackmail takes place. Ever-shifting alliances and factions are formed for mutual protection, and periodically, victims are sacrificed. Usually subordinate officials here and there, sometimes entire factions in giant purges. The fundamental fact driving socialism to a reign of terror is the incredible dilemma in which the socialist state places itself in relation to the masses of its citizens. On the one hand, the socialist state assumes full responsibility for the individual's economic well-being. It openly avows this responsibility. This is the whole source of socialism's popular appeal. On the other hand, in all of the ways we have shown in Lecture 8, the socialist state makes an unbelievable botch of the job. It makes the individual's life a nightmare. Every day of his life, the citizen of a socialist state must spend time in endless waiting lines. For him, the problems we experienced in the gasoline shortage are normal, only he does not experience them in relation to gasoline, for he does not own a car and has no hope of ever owning one, but in relation to simple items of clothing, to vegetables, even to bread. Even worse, as we will see, he is frequently forced to work at a job not of his choice, and which he therefore must certainly hate. And he lives in a condition of unbelievable overcrowding, with hardly ever a chance for privacy. To put it mildly, such a man must seethe with resentment and hostility. Now, against whom would it be more logical for the citizens of a socialist state to direct their resentment and hostility than against that very socialist state itself? The same socialist state which has proclaimed its responsibility for their life, has promised them a life of bliss, and which, in fact, is responsible for giving them a life of hell. Indeed, the leaders of a socialist state live in a further dilemma, in that they daily encourage the people to believe that socialism is a perfect system whose bad results can only be the work of evil men. If that were true, who in reason could those evil men be but the rulers themselves, who have not only made life a hell, but have perverted an allegedly perfect system to do it? It follows that the rulers of a socialist state must live in terror of the people. By the logic of their actions and their teachings, the boiling, seething resentment of the people should well up and swallow them in an orgy of bloody vengeance. The rulers sense this, even if they do not admit it openly, and thus their major concern is always to keep the lid on the citizenry. Consequently, it is true, but very inadequate, merely to say such things as that socialism lacks freedom of the press and freedom of speech. Of course it lacks these freedoms. If the government owns all of the newspapers and publishing houses, then obviously nothing can be printed which the government does not want printed. If it owns all the meeting halls, no public speech or lecture can be delivered which the government does not want delivered. But socialism goes far beyond the mere lack of freedom of press and speech. It totally annihilates these freedoms. It turns the press and every public forum into a vehicle of hysterical propaganda in its own behalf, and it engages in the relentless persecution of everyone who dares to deviate by so much as an inch from its official party line. The reason for these facts is the socialist rulers' terror of the people. To protect themselves, They must order the propaganda ministry and the secret police to work round the clock. The one to constantly divert the people's attention from the responsibility of socialism and of the rulers of socialism for the people's misery. The other to spirit away and silence anyone who might even remotely suggest the responsibility of socialism or its rulers. To spirit away anyone who begins to show signs of thinking for himself about anything. It is because of the rulers' terror and their desperate need to find scapegoats for the failures of socialism that the press of a socialist country is always full of stories about foreign plots and sabotage and about corruption and mismanagement on the part of subordinate officials, and why, periodically, it is necessary to unmask large-scale domestic plots and to sacrifice major officials and entire factions in giant purges. It is because of their terror and their desperate need to crush every breath, even of potential opposition, that the rulers of socialism do not dare to allow even purely cultural activities that are not under the total control of the state. For if people so much as assemble for an art show that is not controlled by the state, as they tried to do in Moscow not so long ago, the rulers must fear the dissemination of dangerous ideas. Any unauthorized ideas are dangerous ideas because they can lead people to begin thinking for themselves and thus to begin thinking about the nature of socialism and its rulers. The rulers must fear the spontaneous assembly of a handful of people in a room and use the secret police and its apparatus of spies, informers, and terror either to stop such meetings or make sure that their content is entirely innocuous from the point of view of the state. Socialism cannot be ruled for very long except by terror. As soon as the terror is relaxed, resentment and hostility logically begin to well up against the rulers. The stage is thus set for a revolution or a civil war. In fact, in the absence of terror, or more correctly, a sufficient degree of terror, socialism would be characterized by an endless series of revolutions and civil wars, as each new group of rulers proved as incapable of making socialism function successfully as its predecessors before it. The inescapable inference to be drawn from this discussion is that the terror actually experienced in the socialist countries has not been the work of evil men, simply the work of evil men, such as Stalin, but springs from the very nature of the socialist system, and is still going on at this very moment. Stalin could come to the fore because his unusual willingness and cunning in the use of terror were the specific characteristics most required by a ruler of socialism. He rose to the top by a process of socialist natural selection, the selection of the worst. His heirs are still resorting to the same techniques. As examples, consider the invasion of Czechoslovakia and the use of drugs to destroy the sanity of dissidents in Russia. And of course, there is no way of knowing what is not reported to the outside world. If Stalin's heirs do not find it necessary to be fully as brutal as Stalin himself, it is only because they are able to coast on the environment of fear and the habit of unquestioning obedience that he created. Periodically, fresh demonstrations of terror on the scale applied by Stalin will be required to prevent socialism from collapsing into continuous civil war and revolution. In the meanwhile, the Russian people do experience all the hostility and resentment I have described, but they are so fearful and so contemptible that they channel it against each other rather than against socialism and its rulers. Hedrick Smith writes, quote, "Soviet society in general is peopled by many dictators, inflicting inconvenience and misery on the rest of their fellow citizens, often, it seems, as a way of getting back at the system for the hardship and frustration they themselves have suffered." He quotes a Russian scientist, put a Russian in charge of a little plot of ground or a doorway somewhere, and he will use his meager authority over that spot to make life hard on others. Smith notes that he has heard Russians describe this phenomenon as, quote, a mass settling of scores on a personal level, unquote. Please observe, this is the psychological and moral climate of a socialist society, a society blinded by terror and reduced virtually to the punishment of all by all. It is terror and universal hatred that socialism and its rulers require, lest they be blasted off the earth. The next point which should be realized is that socialism necessitates a system of forced labor, slavery. Forced labor is implied in the very ideal of socialist planning. If the state is to plan the production of all commodities, it must also plan the skills that the workers will possess who are to produce those commodities, and where those workers are to live and work. It is incompatible with socialist planning for private individuals to have the freedom to acquire the skills they want and to live where they want. Such freedom would alone make socialist planning impossible. Of course, socialism cannot plan in any case. Nevertheless, forced labor remains an essential feature of socialism. As I showed in Lecture 8, the economic conditions of socialism are the same as those which prevail under universal price controls and universal shortages. Socialism, we saw, is characterized by a labor shortage, in which there is a ready and waiting employment for more labor in the production of virtually every good. We saw that the labor shortage under socialism results from the fact that a socialist government wants to expand production, but is unable to trace the connections among the different industries. It is unable to determine the effects of producing more of any one item on the ability to produce other items. As a result, it establishes a quota system, as in Soviet Russia, in which it tries to encourage the maximum possible production of each item. We saw that the labor shortage is compounded by all of the inefficiencies of socialism, which cause a larger amount of labor to be required to produce each good. Finally, we saw that shortages of consumers' goods under socialism act to reduce the supply of labor by destroying the incentive to work and earn money, leading people to stop working. In the face of such conditions, if the government is unwilling to abandon socialism or price controls, however the case may be, its only alternative is to freeze people into their jobs, order them into those jobs and those geographical areas where it considers their work vital, and extract work from them under the threat of physical force. The government must freeze people into their jobs to stop them from quitting in response to the shortages of consumers' goods. It must order them into specific jobs in specific areas for the same reasons it finds it necessary when a shortage exists to allocate crude oil or any other factor of production to the production of specific products in specific places, namely to avoid the chaos of products it considers vital not being produced because other products it considers less important are produced instead. It must extract work by the threat of force because it has no positive incentives to offer. This is a system of slavery. I would like you all to observe the extent to which forced labor exists right now in Soviet Russia, because this is a matter which is almost entirely ignored in the press. Forced labor exists in present-day Russia in the following ways. First, all people living on collective farms, at least 40% of the Russian population, according to the Russian government's own figures, are prohibited from moving away from those farms without the permission of the collective farm managements. In addition, at harvest time, all available urban workers are forced into the countryside to help bring in the harvest. Observe, incidentally, that the collective farming system is so inefficient that 40% of the population is insufficient to bring in the harvest. In the United States, by way of comparison, about 4% of the population is more than sufficient for agriculture. Second, every graduate of a university or technical school in Russia is compulsorily assigned to a job for a period of 2 to 3 years following graduation. Third, every remaining worker in Russia is compelled to have a labor book that details all of his previous employment, including comments by his former employers, reasons for changing jobs, and so on. This book must be presented to each new employer. Employment cannot be obtained without it. The employer then keeps the book so long as the worker is employed at that particular job. Theoretically, since Khrushchev, the employer is supposed to return the labor book at the worker's request. Nevertheless, this system certainly discourages the workers leaving any job against the employer's wishes. All he has to do is write an adverse comment in it. And therefore, it must be considered a forcible deterrent to changing jobs. In addition, it is illegal in Soviet Russia to be unemployed. Since most of Soviet Russia is closed off to foreigners, it is impossible to have any direct knowledge of what goes on in most of the country. But one must assume that it is worse than in the parts that are open to foreigners. Based on my knowledge of the nature of socialism, I see no reason not to believe that there are still millions of people shipped off to do forced labor under deadly conditions, just as under Stalin. Recent estimates place the number of inmates currently in Russian concentration camps at between 1 and 2 million people. It could be substantially higher. If the severity of forced labor in Soviet Russia today is not as great as it was under Stalin, the explanation is largely a more flourishing black market. The black market is now estimated to account for about 20% of Russia's economy. In addition, it is legal for members of collective farms to farm small one-acre plots on their own account and to sell the produce in the cities for whatever prices it can bring. These small plots account for about 4% of the cultivated land in Russia and produce about 30% of its agricultural output. This agricultural output and the black market make it worthwhile for people to work and earn money. Within limits, they provide people with something to spend the money on. Observe, however, how the mitigation of forced labor, and indeed the very survival of the socialist system, depends on the extent to which it violates its own principles. Strictly, according to socialist principles, there should be no black market and no quasi-private farming plots. But it is only by permitting them that the system can survive. Now, I must stress that a system of forced labor could be imposed even in the United States. This could happen either as a result of the open socialization of the economic system, or, as is much more likely, as part of a program of de facto socialization carried out in response to the chaos created by price controls. None of our traditions, none of our past record of freedom would be enough to stop it. It should be realized that such slavery was, in fact, already imposed, temporarily, under the de facto socialism instituted during World War II, in countries with very similar traditions as the United States. It was imposed in Great Britain, Australia, and even Canada. During World War II, workers in those countries could not quit or change their jobs without government permission, and they could be ordered to work wherever the government required them. Similar legislation was proposed to the Congress of the United States by President Roosevelt in his State of the Union message of January 1944. Fortunately, the legislation did not pass. But had the United States been at war longer and the effects of the labor shortage become more severe as a result of the continued operation of inflation and price controls, it is very likely that such legislation would have been enacted even here. The only alternative, given the continuation of price controls, would have been chaos in the allocation of labor and a massive stoppage of work. Thus, if we adopt socialism in this country, no matter what its form, we must expect the same consequences as exist in Soviet Russia. Now let us consider the further consequences of forced labor itself. Once the government assumes the power to determine the individual's job, it obtains the power to decide whether he must spend his life working in a coal mine in some remote village somewhere, or in the comparative comfort of one of its offices in the capital. It obtains the power to decide whether he will pass his life as an obscure nobody living in poverty or enjoy a flourishing career, celebrated in his field and living in comparative opulence. This, of course, goes along with the government's power to ration consumers' goods, a power which every socialist government naturally possesses. Under its rationing power, a socialist government decides what kind of house or apartment the individual is to occupy, what kind of clothing he is to wear, what kind of food he is to eat, whether or not he is to own an automobile, and so on. In Soviet Russia today, for example, the government assigns different grades of housing based on rank in the Communist Party or the government. On the same basis, it decides who can and who cannot buy an automobile. It even maintains special stores that are closed to the general public and which exclusively serve high government and party officials and their favorites in the arts and sciences. These stores carry all kinds of Western imports, from clothing to tape recorders, and the limited supplies of whatever worthwhile goods as are produced in Russia itself. While such things as meat may be unavailable throughout most of Russia for months on end, the privileged customers of these stores are supplied with caviar. The existence of a system of naked aristocratic privilege is not a contradiction of the principles of socialism, but their natural outgrowth. It does not contradict the slogan, from each according to his ability to each according to his need. That slogan was intended by Marx to be achieved only under, quote, socialism in its higher phase. That is, after generations of socialism had changed human nature. If one thinks seriously about the meaning of the phrase, a change in human nature, one must realize that it is a contradiction and therefore impossible. A change in human nature is as absurd an idea as a change in the nature of water or lead. Man will be able to practice the principle, from each according to his ability to each according to his need, when water is able to flow uphill and lead to float. Meanwhile, while it is waiting for human nature to, quote, change, a socialist state is free to adopt any system of distribution it pleases. If that is not a sufficient justification for adopting a system of aristocratic privilege, the rulers of socialism can reply that they and their favorites have special needs. What positively generates the system of aristocratic privilege under socialism is the fact I discussed in Lecture 8, that the only values which count in socialism are the values of its rulers. Please recall that the absence of competition and profit and loss incentives in supplying the consumers make the plain citizens economically impotent under socialism. Production takes place exclusively in accordance with the values of the rulers. What the rulers value is what contributes to their military strength, their prestige, and their amusement. The goods required by the masses for survival enter into the rulers' valuations only to the extent that the rulers need subjects and do not wish to lose too many of them. The nature of the rulers' values determines the nature of the incentives and inequalities of a socialist society. It is not true that a socialist society exists entirely without incentives. That would be true only if it tried to practice the absurd ideal, from each according to his ability to each according to his need. In actual fact, a socialist society does have incentives, but the incentives are geared entirely to the achievement of the values of the rulers. There are no incentives for the achievement of the values of the plain citizens. Under socialism, everyone is debarred from having values but the rulers. Under socialism, no one is permitted to live as an end in himself, but the rulers, who manage, to some extent, at least in the material realm, to live as ends in themselves, under the cover of serving society or mankind. The kind of incentives and inequalities that prevail under socialism are similar to those which prevail in an army. In an army, there are incentives for privates to make corporal and for everyone to advance to a higher grade. But all the incentives in the army are geared to achieving the objectives of the supreme commander. The objectives of the supreme commander are the ultimate ends, definitely not the improvement of the life of the privates. Indeed, neither in an army nor under socialism is the improvement of anyone's life the actual goal. The closest socialism ever comes to making the improvement of life its goal is its alleged concern with the improvement of the life of unborn future generations. But no sooner does the generation of the grandchildren arrive than socialism's concern switches to the grandchildren of the grandchildren. Socialism is essentially a militaristic, aristocratic type society. It rests on a base of starving serfs, comprising the great majority of the population, who live at or below the level of minimum physical subsistence, and whose only function in life is to toil for the values of the rulers. Workers with special skills of value to the rulers may be somewhat better off, if that is what is necessary to make them deliver their skills. But they too are essentially just serfs. They too work under force, and what they receive is subsistence or subsubsistence plus a small bonus for their skill. Above the serfs come varying grades of officials and favorites who help the rulers to exploit the serfs or who provide the rulers with new weapons of war, the means of gaining greater prestige, or simple amusement. In this category are all the production managers, all the lower and middle party and police officials, the propagandists, the intellectuals, the scientists, the artists, the athletes. These are the tools, the henchmen, the flunkies, and the simple court favorites of the socialist society. Finally, at the very top, come the supreme rulers themselves, the men who have outmaneuvered and outgunned all of their rivals. These are the Neanderthals, whose power lust and gluttony socialism elevates to the ultimate end of human existence. A few further words need to be said in reference to the middle strata of a socialist society, especially its intellectuals. As a result of a socialist state's twin powers over the individual's work and consumption, everyone's life comes to depend unconditionally on the good graces of every government official with power or influence. In such circumstances, not only are people stopped by terror from criticizing anything the government or any government official does, but a competition breaks out in the positive praise and adulation of the government and its officials. If you want to know why educated Germans made serious statements about Hitler speaking with God, the Führer of the universe, and why educated Russians praise Stalin as the world's greatest engineer, scientist, philosopher, and so on, this is why. The dictators held all of the material values of these people in their hands, and these people lacked the character to resist trying to gain those values by any means necessary, from self-abasing flattery to informing on their closest friends and relatives. The same thing still goes on today in Soviet Russia, though for the time being, it appears to be somewhat more subdued. In Soviet Russia, no one can rise in his field without the backing of influential friends in the party. Major advancement, including the privilege of traveling abroad, which is one of the most coveted possessions in Russian society, requires serving as an informer for the KGB, the secret police. In Soviet Russia, men betray friends and relatives for the meanest material gains, to be able to buy such things as a Western refrigerator, Western furniture, even a Western toilet. Ironically, the American sympathizers of Soviet Russia, who work for the establishment of a similar regime here, frequently write books and plays denouncing corporate executives under capitalism for allegedly having sold their souls for material advantage. The socialist society that these authors and playwrights yearn for is a society in which the only way that intellectuals can advance is by displaying the most abject servility to Neanderthals, who in the absence of a capitalist world outside could offer them no more than a few scraps of food wrung from some poor serf. This is evidently the path that today's intellectuals find most secure, and the reward that they find most commensurate with their abilities, since a socialist society is what they are striving to bring about. Now, there is a further consequence of forced labor under socialism that I want to consider, namely, its potential for developing into mass murder. To understand how this can happen, we must contrast forced labor under socialism with forced labor under a different system. Observe, slavery existed in the southern United States before the Civil War and was a moral abomination. Nevertheless, abominable as slavery was, there was an important factor which restrained the slave owners and the overseers in the Old South in their treatment of the slaves. And that was the fact that the slaves were private property. A private slave owner in the Old South was restrained in his treatment of his slaves by his own material self-interest. If he injured or killed his slave, he destroyed his own property. Of course, out of ignorance or irrationality, this sometimes happened, but it was the exception rather than the rule. Private slave owners in the Old South were motivated to treat their slaves with at least the same consideration they gave to their horses and dogs, and to see to it that their overseers acted with the same consideration. But under socialism, the slaves are public property, the property of the state. Those who have charge of the slaves, therefore, have no personal economic interest in their lives or well-being. Since they are not the owners of the slaves, they will not derive any personal material benefit if the slaves are alive to work in the future, nor suffer any personal material loss if the slaves are not alive to work in the future. In such conditions, slave labor results in mass murder. The officials in charge of the slaves are given orders to complete certain projects as of a certain time. Quite possibly, they are threatened with being reduced to the status of slaves themselves if they fail. In these circumstances, the slaves are treated as valueless natural resources. Brutal punishments are inflicted on them for trifling reasons, and they are worked to the point of exhaustion and death. The slaves of socialism are slaves, but they are no one's property, and therefore no one's loss. In this way, slave labor under socialism results in mass murder. In just this way, tens of millions of people have been murdered. Of course, the economics of socialized slavery is not a sufficient explanation of mass murder. Those who participate in the system must be morally depraved. But observe how socialism creates the conditions in which moral depravity flourishes. The conditions in which moral depravity can express itself, is freed of the restraints of better motives, and is positively nurtured and encouraged. For it is socialism that delivers men into slavery. It is socialism that removes the restraint of self-interest from those in charge of the slaves. And as we have seen, it is socialism that creates an environment of hatred and sadism. In such conditions, the most morally depraved and vicious element of the population finds a place for its depravity and viciousness and steps forward to run the labor camps and the whole socialist society. We have now seen how socialism can come into existence only by violence and bloodshed and can be maintained only by terror. We have seen how it produces a social system as odious as that of medieval feudalism and results in mass murder. All of these facts are well known to practically everybody as far as they concern particular countries, like Nazi Germany, Soviet Russia, Communist China, Communist Cuba, and a long and growing list of other socialist countries. Yet as I indicated at the outset of tonight's lecture, almost everybody regards all of these cases as exceptional, as an accident, having nothing to do with the essential nature of socialism. Hitler's Germany, they say, was not socialist. Stalin's Russia, they say, did not have genuine socialism or communism, but, quote, Stalinism. The despotism of socialism in Russia under Lenin and under Stalin's heirs, the despotism of socialism in Eastern Europe, in Red China, in Cuba, and in still other countries, all this is attributed to the backward cultural conditions of these countries. It is not attributed to the nature of socialism itself, to the government's ownership of the means of production. Socialism, we are told, will be different when it comes to the West. Here it will allegedly, quote, wear a human face. What is equally remarkable is that the leading advocates of socialism have made no secret of the evil of socialism. They have been as open in stating their goals as Hitler was in Mein Kampf. For example, in the Communist Manifesto, Marx and Engels write, quote, "You reproach us with intending to do away with your property. Precisely so, that is just what we intend." And they declare, quote, "The abolition of this state of things, bourgeois society, is called by the bourgeois abolition of individuality and freedom, and rightly so. The abolition of bourgeois individuality, bourgeois freedom, is undoubtedly aimed at," unquote. Equally barefaced, number 8 of the 10 measures set forth in the Communist Manifesto calls for the, quote, "establishment of industrial armies, especially for agriculture," unquote. The socialists have never made any secret even of their advocacy of slave labor. If the quotation from the Communist Manifesto is not enough, consider these words of Karl Kautsky, the successor to Engels as the leading theorist of socialism. Quote, "Socialist production is not compatible with liberty of work, that is to say, with the worker's freedom to work when or how he likes," unquote. This passage is quoted on page 32 of the introduction to the Gateway edition of the Communist Manifesto. According to Leon Trotsky, addressing the Ninth Congress of the Soviet Communist Party, the worker under socialism is to feel that he is a, quote, "soldier of work who cannot be his own master. If the order comes to transfer him, he has to comply. If he refuses, he will be a deserter who is punished," unquote. This statement is quoted in an essay by Igor Shafarovich in the book From Under the Rubble. Nevertheless, despite the open proclamation of its evil, despite an incredible worldwide record of the murder of upwards of 50 or 60 million people, and of a life of terror and misery for most of those who have remained alive to go on living under its rule, despite all this, socialism has continued to be perceived as some kind of ideal social system. In the minds of most people, it has been misused and perverted, perhaps, but it itself remains fundamentally unblemished. The reason for this incredible state of affairs is that socialism professes an avowed moral ideal of mankind, namely, the ideal from each according to his ability to each according to his need. So long as it professes that ideal, its fundamental goodness goes unquestioned, and any tyranny, any slaughter on its part, is excused as an accident. I am convinced that there are countless numbers of people who could hear everything I have had to say about socialism, every connection I have drawn between its nature, methods, and consequences, and who would still believe in the fundamental goodness of socialism. These people would believe that if only some relatively minor adjustments were made here and there, or if only the rulers of socialism did not turn out to be so, quote, selfish, all would be well. Socialism will never be destroyed so long as the slogan, from each according to his ability to each according to his need, is perceived as a moral ideal. So long as that is held to be the good, men will go on believing that socialism must be good and must somehow be capable of being made to work and to produce good effects. The ultimate destruction of socialism, the rescue of civilization, and the rebirth of capitalism depend on nothing less than a moral and epistemological revolution, as well as on a revolution in political economy and political philosophy. The slogan, from each according to his ability to each according to his need, must cease to be regarded as a moral ideal. It and every premise on which it rests must be subjected to merciless criticism. There is no other choice. If I am right in my critique of socialism, and if socialism is made possible by the moral and philosophical ideas expressed in the slogan, from each according to his ability to each according to his need, then either we extirpate those ideas, or socialism will extirpate the greater part of the human race. As the source of the moral and epistemological revolution that is necessary to defeat socialism, I refer you to the works of Ayn Rand and her philosophy of objectivism. Ayn Rand has dared to challenge the moral system that has been handed down unquestioned for millennia. She has turned the light of reason on the altruist morality, the morality of self-sacrifice. She has demolished it. And in its place, she has offered a morality of rational self-interest. In so doing, Ayn Rand has provided the moral foundations for a capitalist society. I will not try to explain Ms. Rand's contributions in this area in any detail, because to do so would carry us far beyond the limits I have set myself in this course. Instead, I will largely confine myself to enthusiastically recommending to you the list of her works which you have received in the bibliography distributed to you under the title A Capitalist Library. If you have not already read Ms. Rand's works, I urge you to do so. If you have read them, I urge you to read them again. Two selections from Atlas Shrugged are especially relevant, namely, the speeches From Each According to His Ability to Each According to His Need, and This Is John Galt Speaking. These are reprinted in For the New Intellectual. But all of the rest of Atlas Shrugged and all of Miss Rand's other writings are also highly relevant. Based on my knowledge of objectivism, I must say this much about the alleged ideal from each according to his ability to each according to his need. First, it is the projection of a mere arbitrary fantasy that is totally divorced from reality and human nature. And when I use the word reality here, I do not mean merely reality as it happens to be, but reality as it must be. The supporters of the slogan, of course, know this, but that does not trouble them. They go on asserting that it is an ideal nonetheless. Their standards of the ideal are absurd. Second, even as a fantasy, this alleged ideal has the elements of a nightmare rather than a dream. Because let us consider what would be required for human beings actually to be able to work directly from their own abilities to others' needs. In essence, what would be required is that a man be able to experience hunger pangs in the stomach of every other person just as he experiences them in his own stomach. In effect, the world would have to be peopled by a race of Corsican brothers, in which everyone's every experience was experienced simultaneously by everyone else in the same way. If you are unfamiliar with this story, Sid Caesar has mimicked it on television. You have two brothers, one of them is kissing the girl goodnight and the other is swooning because he experiences it. Or to try to concretize the idea in a slightly different way, the human race would have to become some sort of giant spider in which every individual was an interchangeable leg or eye. But let us look specifically at the implications of this fantasy for relationships between individual human beings. Observe, the implication of experiencing hunger pangs in everyone else's stomach in the same way that one experiences them in one's own stomach is that one must experience hunger pangs in everyone else's stomach in the same way that one experiences them in the stomach of one's own wife or children. In other words, if everyone could somehow value everyone else in the world just as he values himself, he could not value anyone else in a special way. If everyone is to be valued equally to oneself, they must be valued equally to each other. Consequently, there could be no exclusive sexual relationships, no special love between parents and children, and no friendships, as well as no self-esteem. everyone would value all members of the opposite sex equally, which would mean he could love no one member of the opposite sex specifically. He would value all children equally, which would mean that his own children might as well be orphans. He would value no one as his friend, because no one he knew would be any more important to him than anyone else he knew, or did not even know. He would not value himself, because he would consider himself no more important than an anonymous villager in Kathmandu or Timbuktu. He would count himself as a mere statistic in a book, as just one more unit in a census of the world's population. As I say, even as a fantasy, such an ideal is nightmarish. The fact that human nature cannot conform to such an ideal is not an imperfection or flaw of human nature, but a condemnation of such an ideal and of anyone unthinking enough to accept it as an ideal. Let us consider why such an absurd idea as the slogan, "From each according to his ability, to each according to his need," is considered to be an ideal and is so popular. I believe that the most important reasons are these, namely, that there are some people who cannot help themselves, and many, many more who fear that they cannot or will not be able to help themselves. In effect, these people fear that their own arms, legs, and brains will fail them, and that they will have no other way to live but by virtue of the arms, legs, and brains of other people. They also fear that they will be utterly valueless to other people, that they will have nothing of value of any kind to offer other people that could induce others to help them, neither money nor any personal quality. These fears are a major preoccupation of their lives. They think of themselves as helpless and worthless, and to them, survival appears to depend on other people being motivated by their needs. Blinded by fear and able to think of nothing but their own projected state of helplessness, they do not know and do not care what they are prepared to destroy in their pleas for a guarantee of help. Observe, they are, quote, selfish in the meanest, ugliest sense of the term, in the very sense in which they employ the word to describe the innocent actions of people seeking nothing but to live and enjoy their own lives. Selfishness in its ugly sense is nothing but the projection of the inner state of someone who hopes to cash in on the slogan, "From each according to his ability, to each according to his need." It is the selfishness of people who expect to have the needs and who desire to live from other people's abilities. Now, the truth is that the fears of people that they cannot survive except as parasites are contrary to fact. The truth is that every normal human adult is capable of surviving by virtue of his own arms, legs, and brain, if only he is allowed the freedom to do so, and if only he tries to do so. He is capable of providing for periods of sickness and incapacity through such means as saving and buying insurance during his years of normal health. And in the normal course of things, individuals form natural bonds of affection. They acquire friends and loved ones who return their affections in response to their own personal values. This, too, is a natural security against periods of sickness and incapacity. To be sure, there are circumstances in which individuals may not have sufficient savings or insurance, and in which they may be without friends or relatives, or the resources of their friends and relatives may be inadequate. What, then, is their guarantee of survival? In such conditions, their only guarantee is the general state of benevolence and goodwill in the society at large, in the form of voluntary private charity. But observe, if we have learned anything in this course, there is one principle that should now be apparent. And that is that benevolence and the goodwill of man toward man are crushed by the morality of self-sacrifice and flourish to the degree that men are free to pursue their own self-interests. Soviet Russia is governed by the principle of self-sacrifice and from each according to his ability, to each according to his need. And as we have seen, it is a society of unrelieved hatred and sadism. The United States of America, on the other hand, has been dominated by the principle of self-interest and the pursuit of happiness. and it has been the most generous and benevolent society the world has ever known. If one were going to be the victim of some disaster and had to depend on the goodwill of other people, it would certainly be infinitely preferable to suffer the disaster here than there. The reasons are not hard to find. If men are made to sacrifice their interests to other men, if they are to have the abilities while others are to have the needs, if others are to drain their energies and consume their lives, then the existence of those others is made a cause of misery and suffering to them, and consequently they must come to hate those others. If, on the other hand, men are left free to pursue their own interests, then nothing becomes more valuable to them than the existence of other men. Every man needs the cooperation of other men in a division of labor. He needs other men for companionship, as a source of ideas, and to be able to share experiences. If men are left free to pursue their own self-interests, if that principle is applied to all men, then the advantages of a division of labor and of personal companionship create countless occasions on which people deal together to mutual benefit, and so come to regard each other with goodwill and often as friends. To put all this another way, if helping others is made the cardinal value of a society, no one will be helped. Everyone will hate and seek to destroy everyone. If, on the other hand, helping oneself is made the cardinal value of a society, then everyone will help himself and in the process help and be helped by others. All will flourish, and that society will be ruled by benevolence and goodwill. Unfortunately, before Ayn Rand, moral philosophy had never been able to get beyond the formalization of blind, neurotic fears. For millennia, it had been concerned with nothing but such matters as helping beggars or deciding how to make room for two people in a one-man lifeboat. Moral philosophy had never looked at the world the way it really is, as it could be made by men guided by reason. It never saw the advantages of a division of labor or even the value of human companionship. It saw nothing but a projected state of human helplessness and worthlessness. And it did nothing but try to teach men to live as bloodsuckers and as fodder, as the eaters and the eaten in that kind of world. As a result, its product has been the perpetuation of misery, hatred, and inhumanity. There is only one thing that the altruist morality is good for, only one instance in which it should be applied. And that is, those who hope to profit from it should choose instead to sacrifice themselves. If people find themselves drowning in a sense of helplessness and worthlessness, and feeling that the only way for them to live is as a parasite on the sacrifices of other men, let them resolve that if those were in fact the conditions of their survival, they would prefer not to survive. Let them resolve to sacrifice themselves and their misery before they would sacrifice others and a world in which men can act for achievement and happiness. But before they decide to give up and die, let them also struggle with every last ounce of will and determination that they possess to go on living under their own power. If that is what they do, then I do not think that they will find themselves nearly as helpless, as worthless, or as alone and without the aid of other people as they fear. And these words are not a mere hope. They are a description of the attitudes and lives of our own ancestors, the people who settled and built this country. Those men and women lived by the virtue of self-reliance in circumstances far more extreme than any we have had to experience. And when they did need help from others, they obtained it because they were respected and admired, precisely because of their self-reliance. The altruist morality and the fear-encrusted view of the world on which it rests must be swept away to allow the world at last to enjoy a rational social system, capitalism. Before turning to the subject of how to achieve a capitalist society, I must stress that capitalism is a system that is in the interests of everyone, and not specifically businessmen or the rich. Everyone benefits from the fact that the means of production are privately owned, and that their acquisition and use are legally open to everyone. The benefit is in people's capacity as the buyers of the products produced with the means of production. That is, in people's capacity as consumers. By the same token, socialism is a system that is against the interests of everyone, and not merely businessmen and the rich. Everyone would suffer dreadfully under socialism in all the ways I have explained. The fight for capitalism, therefore, is everyone's fight. The contrary belief that capitalism serves merely the special interests of the capitalists stems from Karl Marx. It is at the heart of his doctrine of class warfare. Paradoxically, in a milder form, the doctrine that capitalism serves the special class interests of the capitalists is held even by most people who are sympathetic to capitalism. It is held by everyone who believes that the fight for capitalism is primarily the responsibility of businessmen. A second and corollary Marxian doctrine that almost everyone takes for granted in some form is the doctrine of economic determinism, namely the idea that everyone will automatically act for his alleged class interest and will hold an ideology conformable to his class interest. On this basis, people have the expectation that every businessman should automatically be not only an advocate of capitalism, but a rather skilled spokesman for it as well. They are shocked when they see businessmen offering little or no defense of capitalism at all, and when they see more and more businessmen supporting various government controls and sometimes even socialism. The acceptance of these two doctrines of class interest and economic determinism has done more than anything else to make the defense of capitalism impossible and to assure the victory of socialism. Because everyone looks on, waiting for the businessmen to take the lead and do something, merely on the basis of their economic interests. In addition, the acceptance of these doctrines is what has stamped the defense of capitalism with such a profound sense of anti-intellectuality. With a handful of exceptions, nobody realizes that thinking is necessary to the defense of capitalism. All that is necessary, people believe, is that someone be a capitalist. Then somehow he will allegedly know what to say when the socialists explain why they want to take his property from him. The fact is that no purely economic interest is enough to make anyone advocate capitalism, let alone tell him how to advocate it. If economic self-interest really did determine thought, everyone would be an advocate of capitalism, even Karl Marx. Indeed, not only need businessmen not be very skillful advocates of capitalism, but in the absence of their knowledge and acceptance of certain definite philosophical principles, they can be, and very often are, supporters of anti-capitalistic causes, including socialism. For example, consider the publishing industry. It publishes far more books and magazines advocating socialism than it does books and magazines advocating capitalism. Similarly, businesses advertise far more heavily in pro-socialist publications than in pro-capitalist publications. In the same way, they sponsor far more television programs that are pro-socialist than programs that are pro-capitalist. Why do they do these things? The answer in most cases, I am sure, is that they do not even realize the implications of the ideas they are promoting. How could they? That would require a knowledge of principles and an ability to apply them, not just the existence of an interest, not just the existence of an economic interest. In other cases, they may realize the implications of the ideas they are promoting, but suffer from a simple lack of integrity. They may take the attitude that all they have to be concerned with is their economic self-interest of the moment. In that case, it can definitely pay to promote pro-socialist ideas. Galbraith's Affluent Society or Samuelson's textbook, for example, were undoubtedly fairly profitable books to publish. Similarly, it pays to advertise in the New York Times and to sponsor programs on CBS. Indeed, the popularity of socialist ideas has become so great that I doubt if anyone could properly advise a businessman at this point not to advertise in the Times or on CBS. Observe, it is nowadays precisely a businessman's economic interest that ties him to these media and thus indirectly to the support of socialist ideas. It should be clear, therefore, that the fight for capitalism cannot be led by businessmen, least of all by today's businessmen. The fight for capitalism can only be led by intellectuals. It must be joined by anyone who values his life and who cares to think. The fight for capitalism is a fight for a life that is both secure and adventurous. When I say that capitalism offers a secure life, what I mean is that it makes us secure from the threat of such things as famines and plagues and any serious material want. It also makes us secure from such things as the pounding of rifle butts on our door in the middle of the night. Capitalism does not offer the security that we will never lose our job or have to make major readjustments in our way of living. That kind of security, which is what most people nowadays mistakenly think of as security, is incompatible with genuine security. Genuine security requires economic progress and the ability to adapt to changes going on in the world. Progress and change require that people change their jobs and their way of life from time to time. If the attempt were made to achieve a static economy, the effect would be that people might keep their present jobs a few years longer, but they would ultimately end up faced with the terrifying insecurity of being unable to control physical nature. They would be back to the days of famines and plagues. As illustration, just think of the fact that if we stopped scientific and technological progress, then the projections of the ecologists actually would come true, because in that case, we eventually would run out of fuel and minerals. To be secure, therefore, we must innovate and have progress. What makes our lives so much more secure today in the United States than people's lives were in the Middle Ages, or are in most of the world, is nothing but our economic progress. Because of the economic progress we have had, a man who loses his job in the United States today begins from a level that is, say, 100 times greater than minimum physical subsistence. In his period of unemployment, his standard of living plunges to, say, 50 times physical subsistence. But then, because it is probably nothing but further progress that has caused him to be unemployed, as soon as he finds a new job, his standard of living rises above 100 times subsistence. And if the next 50 years were to have as much progress as the last 50, he could easily finish his life with a standard of living several times as great as his present standard of living. This description of events could be taken directly out of our history. For example, think of the horse breeders and buggy makers who were temporarily unemployed as a result of the automobile. They certainly finished their lives with a standard of living several times higher than it was before the automobile. The adventure that capitalism offers is the corollary of its security. It is the adventure of a life of progress. It is the adventure of discovering new knowledge, creating new achievements, learning new skills, and enjoying the novelty of new products. In our ancestors' day, it was the adventure of throwing railroad and telegraph lines across a continent, building giant cities out of the wilderness, and developing great new industries. If we had capitalism today, our great adventure might very well be the exploration of space and the settlement of the moon, and God knows what other fabulous achievements. Both the security of capitalism and its adventure are the manifestations of something still deeper, and that is a life of reason. It is the use of reason that underlies all of the scientific and technological progress of capitalism. It is the use of reason that creates life's security and provides the sense of life's adventure under capitalism. Capitalism is a society totally governed by reason. Reason is its exclusive foundation and omnipresent characteristic. It is because man possesses reason that he is able to enter into a division of labor and thus into society. It is because he possesses reason that he possesses rights. Capitalism, as we have been shown by Ayn Rand, is, quote, a social system based on the recognition of individual rights, including property rights, in which all property is privately owned. which means it is ultimately a system of reason. So what one fights for when one fights for capitalism is not the alleged special interests of the frightened men who are today's big businessmen. One fights for a life of progress, a life of security, a life of adventure, above all, a life of reason. One fights for a life that is proper to man qua man, a life that is proper to man as a rational being. Capitalism is an indispensable precondition of such a life. It is one of man's requirements for survival. And thus, there could be no value more worth fighting for than capitalism. Is there anything to stop us from achieving capitalism? Are we doomed instead to watch the world plunge before our very eyes into a new dark age? There is absolutely nothing to stop us from achieving capitalism. There is no reason in the world why we must watch the destruction of everything we value that has been left to us from an earlier age that was almost capitalist. The belief that the coming of socialism is inevitable is absurd. Every argument that Marx or anyone else ever advanced in behalf of this claim took for granted the superiority of socialism over capitalism. But we have seen through thorough examination that socialism is superior to nothing. It is demonstrably the worst possible social system. Why then must we be drawn inevitably closer to it? There simply is no reason for the inevitability of socialism. There are, however, some very good reasons why almost all of us feel that the coming of socialism is inevitable.